Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Bruce Johnson, and to begin, he presented a 66-year-old woman from his practice.
I first saw her in 2000, and it was kind of interesting because she had a stage 2 adenocarcinoma of the lung, a T2N1. And in 2000, we weren't sure whether one should or shouldn't get adjuvant therapy. It was about 4 years before the information came out, first from the study out of France, taking a look, IALT, the international study. And that was the first information that adjuvant therapy prolonged survival. And therefore, when I saw her and she had stage 2, even though she was young, I elected not to give her adjuvant treatment.
She was a non-smoker?
That's right. She was a never smoker.
So let's see. Was she 50 at that time?
Yeah, she was almost exactly 50 years old. To me, it's sort of a good thing that I've followed people for now 16 years who've had their lung cancer, and it's about a decade since she recurred.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So then what happened?
Well, she went for 6 years with no evidence of disease, and I followed her regularly. And then on a routine chest CT scan, she developed a left-sided recurrence in the chest wall, and it was biopsy proven. And the other thing that had happened, we began routinely sequencing our patients for EGFR mutations in 2004. So 2006 was 2 years afterwards. So we found out she had an exon 19 deletion mutation.
It's really interesting to think about where she fit in historically. So she had this recurrence not very long after the EGFR mutation was actually defined. And I think at that time, it wasn't even clear. A lot of people weren't getting treated up front with TKIs.
That's correct. It was not clear whether you should use the TKIs late. The other thing was at the time, there was somewhat of a controversy about the predictive marker. Some of the folks thought you should be using EGFR mutations, and other folks thought you should use copy number assessed by fluorescence in situ hybridization or FISH. And we were pretty much believers that the mutation was the more predictive marker. So we routinely got the EGFR mutation testing. We were doing it through the Laboratory of Molecular Medicine in Cambridge, which is our collaborators for the Partners Group, the group that works between the Brigham and Women's Hospital, Mass General, and Dana-Farber.
That's fascinating. How did you treat her at that point with the first recurrence?
Well, we were pretty strong believers that people should get treated with EGFR TKIs as initial therapy in 2006. So we gave her the EGFR TKI, and she was one of the people that responded for 4 years.
Wow.
And, was pretty much able to live her life in a pretty routine fashion. She played tennis and hiked and had a pretty normal life for those 4 years.
And how did she do in terms of tolerability with the erlotinib?
Well, as with almost everybody, she would have up to 4 to 6 bowel movements. The skin rash wasn't too bad. She reported dry skin. The interesting thing about our patients who are on the EGFR TKIs for long periods of time is that it sort of peaks with the rash and diarrhea about 4 to 6 months into it, and then it kind of stabilizes with the passage of time. So it actually decreases rather than increases when you get into years 2, 3, and 4. So she tolerated it very well.
And what kind of response did she have?
Well, she had a near complete response. It was about 80% of the tumor went away. And she had what we see in almost everybody, and that is that the maximal tumor response takes place about 6 to 8 months after you start. And that's when you get the minimal disease. And then it will typically start to very slowly grow.
So this lady then had a very good response. And then what was the next step?
So the next step was when she developed progression, we still wanted to stay with targeted therapy. And at the time, we had a study using neratinib, which is a TKI against both HER1 and HER2, or EGFR plus HER2. And we combined that with an mTOR inhibitor. The particular one we used was temsirolimus. And she was able to be treated with that for about 8 months. She had a bit of a response, but then developed progression.
Could I just bring in another issue here? Because it's been interesting when we sort of poll oncologists about the issue of other TKIs, particularly afatinib. So first of all, at this point now, 2016, how do you go about deciding this lady got erlotinib, but if she were to present today, would she still get erlotinib, or are there some situations where you're using afatinib?
Well, the data that I think informs the decision is the data from the combination of the LuxLung 3 and 6 studies, which were two different studies comparing afatinib to either pemetrexed and cisplatin or gemcitabine and cisplatin, both of which showed a PFS advantage for afatinib. When they lumped those two studies together and took a look at the benefit of afatinib versus chemotherapy, they actually saw a survival advantage for giving afatinib in the patients with the EGFR exon 19 deletion mutations. They didn't see a difference with L858R, and I'm actually facing this with a patient that I'm seeing this week who's a health professional, who's aware of the information, and we're going to have a pretty serious discussion about whether it's worthwhile to use afatinib over erlotinib. Now, the history of observing that the exon 19 deletion mutants do better than the L858Rs with the EGFR TKIs actually goes back a decade, when there were studies both from our group published by David Jackman and Greg Riley from Memorial Sloan Kettering showing that people with exon 19 deletion mutations do better with the EGFR TKIs than the patients with L858Rs. In this particular one where you compared afatinib to chemotherapy, it was one of the first where you saw a survival advantage. And all the different studies that have looked at gefitinib versus chemotherapy and erlotinib versus chemotherapy, there wasn't a survival advantage.
In general, nowadays, for example, this patient you're thinking about right now, are you leaning towards afatinib with the 19 deletions?
Yeah, I'm leaning toward afatinib.
And is it your impression that the toxicity is worse?
I think at the recommended dose, there's a bit more diarrhea, but the obvious thing is that, you know, patients can have dose adjustments. At least so far, when people have looked at it, if the patients are dose adjusted, they seem to do about as well as the patients who aren't dose adjusted, meaning in terms of if you take a look at progression-free survival, there's not a dramatic difference between those that need a dose adjustment than those that don't. So we're not terribly frightened from cutting the dose from the full amount.
And is it your feeling, I mean, of course we don't have perfect definitive data on this, that there really is a difference between these TKIs, or is it just the data that's available?
Well, in the U.S., they made it rather simple for us in that the only approved TKI that we had for a decade was erlotinib. So we didn't have to think too much about is there an advantage or not an advantage. For the EGFR TKIs, gefitinib, erlotinib, and afatinib, they're all approved now for EGFR mutant lung cancer. So we do have a choice. I've treated a lot of people with gefitinib and a lot of people with erlotinib, and at the recommended dose, the gefitinib causes less skin rash and diarrhea. However, if you do the dose adjustments with erlotinib, most of the patients tolerate it fine. It's never been a big problem. You just hold the dose if you get greater than grade 3 or 4 diarrhea. The skin rash has been less of a problem for holding the doses. And as I said before, with the passage of time, most of the patients, the skin rash and diarrhea get better, both in terms of learning how to manage it, as well as it seems to have less of a pharmacodynamic effect with the drug.
This lady now is up to 2011, and she's having disease progression. And I see here that even at that point, it was noted that she had a T790M resistance to mutation.
Yeah. And at that period of time, we didn't have a drug for the T790M. It was in the midst of preclinical studies of trying to come up with a class of compounds. And here we switched her over to pemetrexed and cisplatin, the standard therapy. And she tolerated this very well, and she got her 6 cycles of pemetrexed and cisplatin and then got a year and a half of maintenance treatment. And this is pretty characteristic of EGFR mutants in that they tend to have a better response and a longer response to chemotherapy in addition to being sensitive to the EGFR TKIs.
Where are we today in terms of blood-based analysis, for example, T790 mutations?
Well, one of the things that one of my colleagues, Jeff Oxnard, has been working on with the osimertinib is taking a look at the blood-based assays. And then Leisha Sequist has been working with rosalitinib. And Leisha has published their data in Clinical Cancer Research taking a look at the plasma-based assays. And the plasma-based assays reflect what you find out in the tumor biopsy about 70 to 80% of the time. My colleague Jeff Oxnard, who's taken a look at this and the publicly presented information, shows that about 2/3 to 3/4 of the patients who have a mutation in the tumor, you'll pick it up in the plasma. And has almost no false positives, meaning that if you pick it up in the plasma, it's almost always present in the tumor. The thing that's been very helpful and it's been useful for me in managing my patients is that, especially when you're looking for the T790M, the thing that helps and the thing you'll have more confidence in the absence of the T790M is that they also sequence a sensitizing mutation. So if you end up seeing the sensitizing mutation and not the T790M, you can be pretty confident that it's not likely to be in the biopsy. And what I'll commonly do in my patients is keep treating them a bit longer with the first generation EGFR TKI before going on to the biopsy. And one of the things that's happened in Europe is that they do have approval for initial therapy with an EGFR TKI based on a plasma-based assay. We think it's likely going to come here in the United States as well.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, there are a lot of situations where it's kind of hard to access tissue, or maybe you've gotten a needle into it, but you don't have enough for that. I could see that that could be very valuable. What do you think?
Well, the other part, number one is, yeah, it's a lot easier to do a blood test than the biopsy and a lot less expensive. And, you know, the information and the way they design the tests is that you have essentially very few or no false positives. And if that's the case, that's really the scenario you want for it to be clinically actionable. The other one that is of some interest is the patients who test positive in the plasma and negative in the tumor. And, you know, the one question that comes up is, did you just biopsy the wrong part of the tumor, the question of tumor heterogeneity? And people are now going to begin taking a look at treating patients where the biopsies are negative and the plasma is positive to find out if it has the same predictive value as a biopsy.
Wow. That's kind of interesting, really interesting. So before you go on, I am curious about the fact that she got pemetrexed and cisplatin. Is that still the chemotherapy that you're using in this situation, or for that matter, what's your upfront therapy in general with adenocarcinoma?
Well, at that period of time, we had less information about giving PEM-carbo. They hadn't done the study comparing paclitaxel carboplatin with Bev. That study was not out yet. And being somewhat of a purist, we ended up giving pemetrexed and cisplatin. I'm more likely now to give pemetrexed and carboplatin if it's not on a study at the current time.
What about bevacizumab?
I'm a believer that with paclitaxel and carboplatin, I give bevacizumab. I do not give bevacizumab with PEM-carbo, but there certainly isn't unanimity in the oncologic community with that.
And how are you approaching maintenance? You give them PEM-carbo and then PEM maintenance?
That's correct.
So she ended up going another 2 years with that approach. What happened at that point?
Well, at that period of time, she developed progressive disease. I restarted on erlotinib because she'd been off for 2 years. We generally like to see them off of an EGFR TKI for at least 6 months, preferably a year before we'll go back and retreat with it. And we started her in 2013 and treated her for about 10 months. The first time we treated her, she responded for 4 years. And we went back to it. She had a response that lasted about 10 months. And it's pretty characteristic that patients will be sensitive to the next round of treatment, both with TKIs as well as chemotherapy. You know, in general, if a person is off a given type of treatment and you've got 6 months or a year, you can go back and use the original therapy.
So then what happened?
Well, she developed progression on the erlotinib, and we biopsied her, and she did indeed have the exon 19 T790M. And the third generation inhibitor agent that we had available at the time was rosalitinib. And we treated her with rosalitinib, and her tumors regressed. She had the complications that are known with this particular agent of hyperglycemia that we treated with oral hypoglycemics and some insulin. It was early on in the experience with rosalitinib where we now know you probably stay with the oral hypoglycemics rather than with insulin. And as I mentioned, she showed that she was responding at 2 months, but then ended up developing brain metastases in the midst of the therapy. And the protocol there called for holding the rosalitinib while she got her head irradiated. And so she only got about a third of the rosalitinib during that cycle. And then when we imaged her after 4 months, she developed progressive disease, maybe in part because of a lack of exposure to the drug, or maybe it was a short duration of efficacy. You know, it's a little bit difficult to tell.
Going back to the hyperglycemia that she had, how much of a problem was it to manage? And right now, at this point, how much of a problem do you see this as?
Well, in her, it was one of the more serious cases. We ended up having to stop the drug twice because of the symptomatic hyperglycemia. It got up in the 300 and 400s, even on oral hypoglycemics. So it was somewhat of a challenge with her. And, you know, at the time, we thought we had other options for treating her. But one of the things that was pretty clear, based on her side effects related to the drug as well as her evidence of progression, is that it was time for her to come off. The other thing that happens, too, in somebody like this, when they develop brain mets and get a course of whole brain radiation, it makes them pretty symptomatic. You know, it causes the fatigue and tiredness when you're this far into the treatment.
What was the next step?
Well, the next step was, and this is, I think, an illustrative situation, when we biopsied her after the 4 months of ruxolitinib, she no longer had the T790M in her tumor. And we were pretty anxious to get her on osimertinib if we could, particularly on a study. So we put her back on erlotinib to see if we could make the T790M clone emerge again.
Wow. What happened?
Well, it did. We put her on the erlotinib for about 4 months. She had slowly progressive disease, and we biopsied her, and she was positive for the T790M by late 2014. We put her on osimertinib, and she had a near complete response, and she's still doing fine.
Wow. How is she tolerating the therapy?
Well, osimertinib, you know, is designed against the mutant form of EGFR, so it has less effects of rash and diarrhea, and osimertinib does not have the complication of hyperglycemia with it. It's a bit different structurally, although it's also a pyrimidine-based EGFR TKI, and she tolerates pretty well. She can walk 3 miles at a time, climb stairs, even though she's now been at treatment for metastatic disease now for a decade.
What a story. Has she had any after effects from the whole brain radiation?
Well, pretty much everybody has some effects. You know, one of the things that we do now when the patients get treated with radiation, we think they otherwise have a expected long survival, is they get memantine, which has been shown in primary brain tumors to improve patients' function. And she's doing okay. You know, one of the things that happens, the three major side effects related to radiation are short-term memory, fine motor coordination, and balance. And she works pretty hard on her balance. So she does yoga, those kind of activities to try to make her balance a bit better.
That's really fascinating. Where do things stand today with ruxolitinib? I was trying to figure out what's going on with the drug. There was some discussion about whether it was as efficacious as it was originally thought to be, whether it was as efficacious as osimertinib. What's going on with all that?
Well, we've used both drugs. Both drugs are active in the clinical situation for which they're designed.
Right now, just based on what you know, what role do you see for the drug, given the fact that you have osimertinib available?
Well, one of the things I haven't seen is that when they published the data in 2015 in the New England Journal of Medicine, with 20% of the patients having progressed, so 80% of the patients were censored, they said they had a median PFS of 13 months. You know, one of the things that we do in oncology is that if there's clear evidence of efficacy, we learn how to treat the side effects. And people know how to treat diabetes. Almost all of us have some people with diabetes in their practices. However, if the results are equivalent, it's a bit more of a challenge to use the drug with that particular side effect.
What about cross-resistance? Have responses been observed, or patients been treated with ruxolitinib who previously got osimertinib and vice versa?
So I don't know that particular sequence, but one of the things that has happened is that the Mass General Group, led by Alicia Sequist, published information on patients who had received ruxolitinib who then were treated with osimertinib, and they had 9 patients who were treated who developed progressive disease, and of those patients, they had a number of responses in that group. So for the patients who have been on that drug, we think it's appropriate, that drug meaning ruxolitinib, is to consider osimertinib, particularly if you come off for toxicity, because it's still potentially active in that setting. They published that in JAMA Oncology.
Interesting. Now, this lady, as you mentioned, had brain mets required whole brain radiation therapy. In general, what are your thoughts about utilizing systemic treatment as opposed to radiation therapy in cases like that, specifically in patients with EGFR mutations, TKIs?
Well, one of the things that we've looked at is what effect the EGFR TKIs have on brain mets. And one of the things we did is we went back to the pre-EGFR TKI therapy days and sequenced a number of patients. And one of the things we've learned for the EGFR mutants is if you get an EGFR TKI instead of chemo as initial treatment, it turns out that you can delay the onset of brain mets. The rate of developing brain mets is about half if you have an EGFR mutation and you get a TKI than if you get chemotherapy. So first of all, it can help delay it. Now, in general, one of the things that happens for an EGFR TKI therapy is that it does cause a response, but typically the response is about half to one-third the duration of what you see in the systemic response. And you can get symptomatic as well as radiographic regressions, but they tend not to be prolonged. So in our patients, unless they're part of an investigational study, we'll attempt to give localized therapy, if we can, radiosurgery. Typically, if they have somewhere less than 3 to 5 lesions, depending on where they are, how big they are. And for the patients who have more than 3 to 5, we will typically give whole brain radiation in the patients.
What about other TKIs coming along? I know there's one BI-1482694 with breakthrough designation for T790 disease. What is that agent and what other TKIs are out there? And is it likely they're going to provide some advantage over the ones we already have?
Well, the one that you mentioned, that agent has been in trial, the BI drug, for several years, but they believe that they may have been giving too low of a dose. So they have been working on increasing the dosage of that medication. The, at least in my opinion, the publicly available clinical data is it's a little bit hard to know if it offers any advantage over the current ones. The thing that we're moderately optimistic about is at least a third of the patients who develop resistance to both osimertinib as well as ruxolitinib is that they develop a C797S mutation. The cysteine moiety is where the drug binds so that they develop mutants. So there are ongoing efforts to develop drugs that are active in those that develop that C797S mutation. And those are what we're hoping for. The other part that people are working on to make the EGFR TKIs more active is combination treatments. And some of the leading combinations include both MEK inhibitors and MET inhibitors in combination with the third generation EGFR TKIs.
Wow, that's interesting. I haven't heard that one. I want to pick your brain a little bit about what the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium has come up with over the last couple years. I'm going to ask you kind of a simple question that I ask all the time, and I'm pretty confused about the answer, which is, what do you suggest that an oncologist in general practice do in terms of mutation testing? It would seem to be a fairly simple question, but in terms of EGFR, ALK, next-gen sequencing, is it different? Maybe we can just focus on non-squamous to start with. Do you approach a non-smoker differently than a smoker? Do you approach a sick patient differently than somebody who's not sick? Any simple algorithm you can give us?
Well, I think at the current time, the mutations that one should test for or tested by immunohistochemistry should be EGFR, ROS, and ALK. They're all approved drugs for those indications. And when you see a new patient with non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer, you should make certain that they have all those tests. One of the things that will happen and things that are coming down the line, and this is something I personally work on, is we have information that has been publicly presented that we've seen 2/3 of patients with V600E BRAF mutations have a response to the combination of dabrafenib and trametinib, and that has FDA breakthrough status. And we think that that has a strong possibility of getting approved based on the phase 2 data. There'll be new data presented at ASCO this year. So therefore, that would make 4 genes with several more on the way. One of the things that happens is that you don't want to have to send your material to one laboratory to get an EGFR mutation and another laboratory to get ALK and ROS. And you'd like to get them all done. And one of the things that happens on the next generation sequencing panels is that you'll get not only those results, but you'll get BRAF, as well as you will get an additional typical somewhere between 50 to 400 genes. And the part that is potentially helpful is that the folks who put these together had put in almost all cancer-related genes that they think may be related to or have an impact on the efficacy of the targeted and immunotherapy drugs. And therefore, we recommend, and you know, the costs are not terribly different to get the large next-generation panels as it would be to get all those individual tests. And you know, for us, since 2013, we've characterized all of our patients for at least 300 genes because we think that that will be informative for the treatments. And one of the other things that people are doing is also now using these next-generation panels to try to develop a subset of taking a look to find out what mutational load is and find out if you can use the next-generation panels as potential predictive markers for who is likely to respond to the checkpoint inhibitor therapy, with the observation being that the more mutations you carry, the more likely you are to develop a response to checkpoint inhibitor therapy.
It sounds like, if possible, for non-squamous, you think that, you know, next-gen sequencing is the way to go. What's the amount of time it takes to get it done?
It's typically about 10 days to 2 weeks after they have the specimen.
And so, you know, do you think we're kind of in a situation sort of like ER and HER2 with breast cancer? You just wait until you have it before you start treatment?
Well, what we end up doing is that we make a judgment with our patients. We have a rapid EGFR and an ALK immunohistochemistry and ROS1 immunohistochemistry that can be done within 2 days. And so we can generate that information. At the current time, you know, the others, for instance, the BRAF mutant, that information's been generated in second-line patients so that you have that length of time. And then if you really don't have time, you know, you can give empiric chemotherapy for the patients if you don't think you have those couple of days. The thing that's a bit of a challenge if you're out in a community practice and you don't have access to rapid testing, it's more of a challenge.
What about the issue of first-line therapy in patients with other mutations? You mentioned BRAF, and there are a number of others that we'll talk about today. Are we going to need to do sort of an IPASS-like study on every one of those, or is there some other way we'll be able to sort of move quicker into first-line therapy?
Well, the ones that I mentioned that I think everybody should have if you have a non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer in March of 2016 is EGFR, ALK, and ROS, and there are pretty good immunohistochemical tests for ALK and ROS. So at the current time, if a person has an EGFR, an ALK, and a ROS1, that covers most of the things that you're going to need to treat right away as initial therapy.
So I take it then that you wouldn't think about that for a patient with a BRAF. You would go with chemo first?
Well, the information on initial therapy in an untreated cohort is information that has yet to be presented publicly. So that's not something out there. You know, one of the things that I'm a big believer in, one of the things that we've had the luxury of doing is that, you know, we've been genotyping our patients for at least 10 genes since 2008. And we've gradually added to them. So as I mentioned now, it's 300. It's a pleasure to practice with that because you know ahead of time what patients have, and if a drug becomes available for a specific mutant, we have the capability of searching databases and finding all the people with that specific genomic abnormality and then being able to put them on a trial.
Interesting. What other mutations are out there right now that, you know, are sort of coming into the consciousness based on the research that's being done? One that we've seen some data on the last year or two have been RET, also MET.
RET is a rearrangement. It's present. It's the sort of 1 or 2 percenters that we see. And some of the agents that have some activity are cabozantinib is one that's been reported by Dr. Drillin from Memorial Sloan Kettering. Those don't have drugs that have been specifically designed for that specific rearrangement in part. So we don't see real high levels of activity. The responses are typically about a third of the patients respond to the different RET inhibitors. The other class of agents that you didn't mention are the NTRK rearrangements, and those drugs are just now becoming available.
What kind of rearrangement? What is that again?
NTRK, N-T-R-K.
Huh, what's that?
It's one of the other rearrangements that we see in lung cancer, and it's a tyrosine kinase, once again, that you can target.
That's interesting. What about MET? That seems like it's more common.
Right. We've been characterizing our patients for MET amplification for the last about 7 years. And when the patients have greater than 5 copies, about 2/3 of them respond to crizotinib, which was originally designed as a MET inhibitor rather than ALK inhibitor. That was where it initially entered trials. And so that's active in high-level amplification. However, those that have greater than 5 copies are 1% or less. So it's relatively uncommon. The new one that's become available is a skip mutation in exon 14, which activates MET and prevents its degradation. And that is pretty effectively targeted with crizotinib. There's a number of studies out there that have used MET inhibitors for the exon 14 skip mutations, and we've seen responses in those groups of patients.
And what's the incidence of that particular mutation?
It looks like it's about 3%.
That's quite a bit.
So it's not a trivial number. The other part is that there's also the patients with the exon 14 skip mutations, as we see in some of the other mutants, are also amplified. So the studies are currently in process to find out what proportion of those that are amplified at 5-fold or higher also have an exon 14, because that actually could be the marker that's driving the responses that are being seen.
So I'm going to go on to your next patient, your 54-year-old lady. Can you talk about her?
Yeah, this was one that was a very interesting situation where she was initially in Europe and presented with a seizure, and they imaged it, and she had a left frontal lesion and had it resected, and then got whole brain, and they started erlotinib on the basis of her clinical characteristics. She was a relatively young woman with an adenocarcinoma and a never smoker. And they did it while they were waiting for her EGFR mutation test to cook. And when it came back negative, they took her off and put her on PEM-CIS, which she tolerated pretty poorly. And she elected to come to the United States and was seen here by one of our private practice groups. And in 2010, there was enough information available that they arranged for her to undergo ALK testing. And then she came to us with the potential to participate in a trial once she was ALK positive. And she went on the randomized study of docetaxel versus crizotinib, and initially randomized to the chemotherapy arm. She got 6 months of docetaxel and then progressed. Well, she had 7 cycles and came off because of toxicity, and then we had to wait till she had evidence of progression. And that took several more months. And then once she progressed, we switched over to crizotinib in 2011. And she's been on it since. She's my longest duration of treatment of any of the patients that I've seen that have ALK rearrangements.
Wow, what a story. How did she tolerate the crizotinib? Any issues?
There were a couple of things that were interesting about how she did this. She would run 5K races. She traveled all over the world, and she was pretty close to asymptomatic on the drug, and she never had a dose reduction on this. There were 2 things that were kind of interesting. You know, because she was on study, you know, they monitored the QTC interval on this. You know, it's the time of repolarization that we do with almost all the EGFR TKIs. And she wasn't on any meds other than the drug. And because she exercised so vigorously, her pulse rate would get down in the 40s and 50s. And when she got down with a real low pulse rate, her QTC interval would get long. And so she quit being quite as sort of marathon fit to get her heart rate to speed up a little bit so that she wouldn't get into trouble with the QTC interval. The other thing that happened, and this is one of my first lung cancer patients where this ever happened, is that she was on the drug so long that all the follow-up for the trial ended, so she had to switch to a commercial drug supply.
Wow. So any thoughts about why she responded for 5 years and very few other people do?
Well, we as a number of other people are studying the tumors of the patients with the real long responders to try to get some kind of idea about why this may happen. We don't have any particular insight into why this happens, but we think it's very important for us to study these patients and find out why some people respond for years and others won't.
You think it's the tumor or the host?
I think it's the tumor.
Hmm. Different kind of, like what? What could it be?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that happens that we do know, and especially with ALK, is that there are sort of a myriad of adaptations that give rise to resistance. A third of them have mutations within the ALK locus. There's others that develop bypass, and there's others that are undefined. And I think the underlying predisposition of the tumor to develop one of those pathways cause it. But, you know, that's speculation.
Where are we today in terms of second-line therapy for patients with ALK rearrangements? And what would you do with, for example, this lady if she had a progression?
Well, I mean, the drugs that are currently approved for patients who progress on crizotinib are ceritinib and alectinib. And those two drugs are active in previously treated patients. There isn't a predictive marker for which of those drugs should be used. I've used both, and both drugs have activity in these patients. The one part that is pretty encouraging is that the alectinib in the subgroup of Japanese patients who were previously untreated is that the median time to progression of people who are giving alectinib as the initial agent when they have ALK rearrangements is in excess of 27 months, which is incredibly long. And the survival at 3 years is about 80% or higher. And so that is pretty encouraging. I've just heard it presented. So we look forward to seeing how that looks. But that's the information I consider pretty encouraging.
That is really amazing when you think about it. What about tolerability? We've heard a lot about GI issues with ceritinib.
Well, I mean, all the drugs are tolerated after you do the dose adjustments. You know, from the published data, all of them have some GI toxicity. But, you know, once again, you know, in my opinion, using these drugs versus using chemotherapy, it's like night and day. You know, almost all these patients would much rather have the targeted agents against ALK than having chemotherapy.
Right now, what in general is your second-line therapy?
Whatever we have a study for, number one. Number two is that I think there's quite a bit and longer data in the recurrent setting with ceritinib. But I think as we get more experience, the data from alectinib is very encouraging.
So does that mean you generally start with ceritinib?
I'm going to restate. I have the privilege usually of putting them on investigational therapy. But I think in general, when we do this, we like to use the drug that has the longest experience in the recurrent setting. And the trials were started earlier with ceritinib here in the United States. Alectinib, their development strategy took place largely in Japan.
When you do use ceritinib, what dose do you start with?
I start with the recommended dose and cut it.
Although I guess most of your patients are going on trials, so you maybe don't deal with that. Although I've heard people talk about starting at a reduced dose, but I guess that's not uniform. Where do you think things are heading in terms of ALK disease, you know, particularly what you just described with the alectinib up front? Do you think these, quote, second-generation agents or second-line agents are going to end up moving up front?
Well, the randomized studies have been done comparing crizotinib versus alectinib, and that should read out in about another year, a year and a half. So we look forward to that information. One of the things that I've learned over the years, it's very difficult to predict the future, especially if it hasn't happened yet.
I like that.